Welcome to Empowered, Mind Body Inspiration. The mind is the map to wholeness, wellness, health. The heart is the key to genius and inspiration. Join me and my guests as we explore how to release and rewire into who you truly are, unique, whole, and empowered. Please like, share, and subscribe. Spiral up, spiral out. Welcome, everyone. Today we have David Ditchfield, and we're covering one of my favorite subjects, life after life. David was dragged under a speeding train, and while he was being recovered by surgeons, he had an amazing life after, or a near-death experience. And he came back with some vivid memories of what it was like on the other side. And he also came back with some amazing abilities to paint and create classical music that he didn't have before this event. David has also been featured in Dr. Raymond Moody's blog, and he wrote the most famous book, which I read, Life After Life. So it's a pretty incredible experience, and we're going to hear it from David today. So David, let's start out. I want you to share what it was like that day when this happened to you, but how did it change your life? Just a little bit of before and after, how it affected you.
Yeah, sure. It changed my life in as much as I got a completely different perspective. I would say that my perspective was very sort of linear. You know, it was all on the surface. I didn't really have any spiritual beliefs or anything. And anything that went wrong in my life, I always looked for the quick fix, you know, which in my case was going to the nearest bar and with my friends and just having a drink, you know. Also, I was struggling to get by in life. I was living in London just before the accident, and like all capital cities, it's very competitive and very expensive. And I was really only picking up work, working on construction sites, doing manual labouring. And I struggled with that. I wasn't very good at that kind of work, to be honest with you. So the gears were always grinding in my life. So the day of the accident itself, I was actually in Cambridge at the time because I'd gone to stay with my sister there because I was broke, basically. I got no money left, and she said, come stay with us. I'd met a friend just a few weeks prior to this, and we just connected, and we got on really good, and she came up to stay with me, and it was her that I was seeing off at the station. And as I helped her on with her bags onto the train car, I was giving her a hug, saying goodbye and giving her a kiss. And then the automatic doors closed and my coat got trapped well inside there. It was wedged in there and I couldn't pull it free. It was a cold February day. And it was a very thick quality sheepskin coat. It wasn't going to come out. I just looked around for a guard, and there wasn't one on the actual train platform itself. In fact, there was only one other guy who'd been seeing off his girlfriend, and he shouted at him. He said, take your coat off, mate, you know, take it off. But I knew that I wasn't going to get it off because of the thickness of it. So the train engine started to rev up, and the fear that started to go through me was quite immense because I was looking into the eyes of my friend Anna, who I was seeing off, and I just saw terror in her eyes. And as soon as I saw that look, I just figured at that point, this is the moment I'm going to die. And it pulled out the station at tremendous speed, the train itself, and I just felt every gear shift. Then I got pulled onto my feet, and I was dragged along the platform edge itself, and then between the space of the platform and the actual speeding train, which I don't know how that happened because it's a very, very tiny space, but the sheer pull of it, I had no choice but to go down there. So it was like really going from that moment into like being thrown into the gates of hell, you know. It was straight into darkness and being thrown around relentlessly. And it was like, I felt like it was just me, flesh and bones, fighting for life against this huge beast of a mechanical machine, if you like. And I was determined not to die. I just determined to live. And I just was conscious throughout the whole ordeal. And it was very violent, very, very terrifying. And then I suddenly found myself thrown to the ground as the train continued on. And I just kept my face down into the gravel. And I just thought, it's not over yet. You know, I could get hit by some of the undercarriage. And it's incredible because my mind had time to think this through and to process what was happening. It was like my mind had stretched. It wasn't slow motion, but I had time to really calculate all this. And I thought to myself, think of all the 007 James Bond movies you've seen, Indiana Jones. What would they do now? Yeah, they keep right down. So that's what I did. So I kept my head down. Then the train finally moved on and disappeared off down the track. So, yeah, it all happened very fast, and it was like, wow, I'm alive. An incredible feeling.
Yeah, but you must have had some life-threatening injuries.
Yeah, I did do, yeah. I mean, I was torn about pretty bad. I mean, my left arm got severed in this because, you know, I got tangled in the machinery and just thrown around at great speed. So, yeah, that was the first thing I'd noticed, that my arm was ripped right open and it had been severed. And so I lost an awful lot of blood, which was really the main threat to my life, was that blood loss. Yeah. But the emergency guys arrived really quick, so that saved me, really, because there was a small hospital just around the corner. So they were there in minutes, actually, and got me into an ambulance. And we sped off down the motorway at great speed. We went to another hospital. The doctor said to me, look, there's a hospital around the corner, but the one that's going to save you is a 20-minute drive. Can you hang on? And I was going, yeah. So he just kept saying to me, stay with me. Stay with me, David. So I did.
Incredible. And to have landed right between the tracks was miraculous, really.
I know. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's the odds of me surviving were just unbelievable. I mean, the British Rail Police they took a whole year doing inquiries on the whole offence, and they calculated everything. Like, they stripped the carriage down to the last rivet of the doors, and they said afterwards, look, we bang in our heads together and we don't understand. You should be dead. You should not have survived that, But I knew that something bigger than both me and that train saved me that day. Something with a higher force and power that was right behind me and determined to keep me going.
And you've done such beautiful things after coming back. So how long was it from the time your coat got caught in the door to the time that the ambulance arrived? It can't have been that long.
No, it wasn't. It's interesting because the rail police managed to calculate everything, and because they got all CCTV footage and stuff. And I asked them, I said, how long did it take from the moment I got caught and they pulled out the station? He said 13 and a half seconds, and I couldn't believe how fast that was, because it felt like minutes to me, because like I said earlier, it's like I was given this 35 millimeter camera and I was able to take everything in. But so they arrived literally within minutes, because I was quite shocked, because I remember lying there on the track, and I'd seen my arm ripped open, and funny enough, I didn't freak out when I saw that. I actually saw all the workings within my arm. And I remember thinking, wow, that's amazing. That's me. That's the inside of my body, like I've never seen, And so, and it was at that point pretty well, actually, no, I tell a lie. I tried to get my cell phone out of my pocket to phone my sister to alert her and say, look, can you phone an ambulance? because I knew no one else was around, And obviously the phone was smashed, but it was at that point that they came jumping down on the track and started cutting through my clothes.
So did you feel pain at that time, or was it pretty surreal?
A bit of both, to be honest with you. I did feel an immense amount of pain, because it was just, a terrific amount. But there was a sense of, adrenaline also. There was a huge adrenaline sort of thing from when the actual moment it happened, that kind of also kind of helps you in a sense, what I mean? I remember when I was a small kid at school, I remember being in a fight in the playground at school, and I remember I'd never got into fights before, and this young kid, he like punched me in the face and it really hurt. And then the second one, I didn't feel it so much. And so I kind of figured it was a bit like that you kind of get almost not used to it, but there's something about human nature anesthetizes it to a certain extent. But it was pretty gruesome pain all in all.
Yeah. Yeah. And your arm was severed, which must have been just incredibly.
Yeah.
OK. Well, I'm going to pass this to Carl to hear more of your experience and see what questions he has.
Hi, David.
Hi. Hi, Carl.
So I was just, you were explaining that incredible event, but it seems that you were aware all the time through it. And so as I was expecting you to describe this kind of state where you'd see a light at the end of the tunnel, did that sort of thing happen? Or was it just that you were aware of this horrendous thing that happens, this event, all the time? You seem to be phenomenally mentally alert. And so I was wondering what state of consciousness, or did it change during the whole thing?
Well, it all changed when I got to the hospital. I had a near-death experience when I got into the emergency department. They got me in the A&E, as we call it here. And all the doctors were like frantically trying to save me. You know, I could hear all this science going over my head, and I thought, what are they talking about? But they sounded worried, you know. And my family had arrived as well. They got there really quick. And, you know, my mother was in tears talking to me, I remember. And it was pretty much around that time that I went from that, all that franticness and all that fear, because I just thought, it's not over yet. I thought, I wasn't sure that I was going to make it, that I suddenly left my body and I went into what I would call another realm altogether. You know, I left all the frantic sort of intensity of that hospital, and I was now in a peaceful place. And I was in what appeared to be like a darkened space. And I figured straight away that I was dead. I thought, this is it. I didn't make it. I'm dead. And I didn't fight it or resist it. I know some people do. I've since, you know, been talking to other people. But for me, that wasn't the case. It's not like I wanted to die, but it was just such a blessing to suddenly go away from everything and just feel calm. So I looked around, and I was kind of greeted, if you like, by these beautiful colors, like there were orbs that were like sort of slowly pulsating all around me, and that made me feel calm straight away. And I tried to assess the situation, as you would do. I looked around and I realized that I was like no longer wearing any clothes, but I was just covered in like this blue satin sheet which was very comforting. And I was laid on like this huge kind of like stone rock, like a slate rock, like a medieval altar is the best way I always describe it. But it felt very comfortable, despite the fact I was not wearing a shirt or anything. And so I just laid back onto this rock. And I just, as I did, I looked up, and then the three grids of white light suddenly closed in on me, like symmetrical grids. And I couldn't take my gaze out of the light. And that light just, because I felt it was more than just light. It was like I felt that it was healing me. It was doing me good. And then I felt the presence of somebody near, and I felt that there was a person stood near me, and there was. I looked at my feet, and there was like somebody almost greeting me, if you like, an androgynous being with this pure white sort of blonde hair, with skin that was glowing light from within, and wearing a very simple contemporary black T-shirt. And I just felt that I'd known this person, you know, throughout the whole of my life and beyond. You know, there was this knowing, there was a connection. And I said, "Who are you? I know you, don't I?" And he or she just kept staring back at me with this almost like a knowing smile, a comforting smile, and didn't answer me. But that was fine. I just laid back my head and felt guarded. I felt that I was being protected. A little later on, I felt the presence of two more people at a right. Well, I felt the presence of people. And I opened my eyes, and there were two female forms either side of me. And there was a young lady to my right who was just wearing, again, a very simple brown dress with long brown hair. And the girl to my left was more Asian Indian, American Indian appearance. And she was wearing a more traditional dress. And they had their hands just slowly hovering over my body as if to send energy of love, it felt like, that was coming from them, that was radiating over my body and healing me, healing the trauma that I'd just been through. But I sensed that it was also more than that. I felt like they were healing all the wounds, the emotional wounds that I carried throughout my life, that we all do, you know. And So yeah, so it was a very beautiful moment to be feeling all that. And the actual tunnel of white light that you asked me about, that I didn't actually see that till the very end of the near-death experience itself. That was the most profound moment, because this energy of love and healing that I was talking about coming from the hands and the light grids was suddenly intensified. It was like turned up, like a big dial had been turned up, and every single molecule in my body was vibrating with this love. And I looked, and beyond my feet, I could see this huge tunnel of white light, and it was just closing in on me. And the tunnel of white light was just like, it was awesome and very frightening to look at, because it was got all these kind of flames that were slowly rotating around, very powerful flames. But I didn't feel any fear at all, because there was no sense of those kind of emotions in this realm at all, you know. And I just felt nothing but excitement. And I knew at this moment in time that what I was staring at was the source of all creation. In fact, that's what I was being told through telepathy, that this was, you know, God, if you like, or whatever faith you may have. This is a creator. It's not, you know, like most gods that we all tend to worship, carry some kind of form in human form. Whereas this was a tunnel of white light, and this was it. This is where it all comes from. But the energy was just so profound. It was brilliant. And so that was I did see it there, Carl. Yeah, so that's what I saw.
Yeah, no, that's it's so vivid in what you describe, and some of the things are from what I understand are shared by other people who've experienced this afterlife state. My question, I have another question, is do you think the point of change in your life of this event, do you think it was due to the actions of those healers in that state who were laying hands on you, or was it the whole experience itself, or is it unfair to separate the two? Or yeah,
no, that's a great question, because I do separate the two, because the healers were very much a part of it, because I felt that, as I said earlier, they were healing the essence of my soul. They were healing all the emotional baggage that I'd carried throughout my life. And I carried a lot. I used to carry a lot of guilt and shame, because I felt like I'd messed up in my life a lot. So all that was being kind of peeled off me bit by bit. But ultimately, I would say that the whole experience itself changed my life, because for the first time, I was in the moment, if you like. I was just in the present moment, and I didn't care about past mistakes anymore. And I wasn't concerned about fears about the future or anything. And so I brought that back with me. But also the essence of pure love was really important as well. I'd got no self-love before, so I came back with a lot of self-love, and then that gave me self-belief, and then things follow on from that. So, yeah.
So was this change like instantaneous, or was it a gradual progression afterwards? Was it like, you know, you woke up afterwards and you were different, or was it took a few days, or did it take a longer period?
Well, when I first came back, I would say that, yeah, I'd instantaneously felt completely different. I mean, when I first came back to my body, you know, everyone says to me, oh, you must have been disappointed. And in fact, I wasn't, because I was just so charged with all this beautiful knowledge and love and energy that I thought, how am I going to tell the world about this and tell people about it? Because it's just so tremendous. And what is my mission? Why have they sent me back? So that's all I could think when I was recovering in hospital. But throughout my stay in hospital, you know, my family and friends would come and visit me, and they all commented. They didn't know what had happened, but they all commented that they'd seen a change in me. They were going, you look so animated, you know, you just I've never seen you like this before. You look incredible, you know. I was expecting to see, you know, far worse and stuff. So yeah. But in saying that, interestingly enough, 6 months later, I crashed down emotionally, because I think what happened was I come back with all this love, and all I could feel was like, yeah, I just want to give love to the world and stuff. But of course, the reality is that society is not geared up for that. And I wasn't geared up for the fact that, you know, it wasn't going to happen. So I had to readjust myself to think, you know, it's not feasible just to come back thinking that you're suddenly a changed person, that life's just going to suddenly be great. You know, I had to adjust. Yeah.
Yeah, so there was a noticeable change at the beginning, but I guess as having asked the question, I was thinking this experience has allowed you to touch something.
Yeah.
That ever since you've touched it, you now still do continually.
That's right.
Maybe yeah. Periodically. And doing that, that's having a continual transformative effect.
That's certainly, yeah.
So it's probably instantaneous as well as a gradual, continual, ongoing process, the change due to this experience.
Yeah, absolutely it is. Yeah, I mean, basically what it is I for the first time in my life, I got in touch with my higher consciousness, you know, and that's really what it's all, the core of it, I feel. Yeah.
Would you associate things like with God or with the higher consciousness, or would those be kind of in your philosophy somehow coupled together at a deeper level?
Yeah, it's coupled together at a deeper level, I would say.
Yeah.
It's not just a question of God. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I can ask all kinds of questions here, but yeah. I'm just kind of someone having that experience. I'm just trying to fathom that. I guess we all have little experiences in our life, so I suppose we can relate to a change in our lives, but something like this is I'm not sure if I can make that extension from my own experience, what it was like, because you have such a vivid memory of everything.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting because I was scared I was going to forget it all right at the beginning, but I never have, because.
Right. And all these great deep kind of connections, there's no fear and a sense of trust and to have a great memory of that.
Well, it's the interesting thing is as well, because I've worked with it since, through my art, and then my music. And now I bought a book out last year, so that meant that I've been talking a lot about it. And so the energy is kind of slowly, constantly sort of opening up for me. And I feel that the connection to that realm is still very strong. And I'm still learning, I'm still getting information just coming through to myself, as I speak. I'm just kind of like, so it's great. So it's a wonderful process just to keep moving forward with it. Because it always feels like there's never been points in my life where I've stopped thinking about it, or it's become it's kind of faded out of my view, if you like. For me, it's always been a very central part, of my journey, and I'm sure it will remain to be that way. And I know it has been for an awful lot of other people I've spoken to who've had NDEs. It's a very profound moment. Because it's not like a dream state either. It's like I describe it to people as being ultra real. It's a different realm, but it's as real as we're all sat here talking now.
Fantastic. I suppose fear is probably the big thing that changed. Do you have a fear of death? Or is that lessened?
I don't have a fear of death at all, actually, because I realize now that the soul is too far greater an entity just to suddenly switch off, once we die. Yeah, the body does and slowly decays, but the soul continues on, because when I was in that realm itself, as I say, it was me, but it was the pure essence of my soul that was in that space. So I know for sure that that's what happens. And not only that, it also helps me. I lost my mother 18 months ago, as hard as it was like for all of us, losing her, it was made a lot easier for me because I knew immediately where she was going. I knew that she was going to be going straight into this beautiful place, and that made me happy, just to know that. So it's a great comfort.
Would you classify this whole thing as a gift?
It certainly is a gift. Yeah, for me, a personal gift. I don't know. I don't know why it happened to me. I mean, the only thing that I can think of is that I wouldn't call it a wake-up call, but it, in my life just reached a point where it could go no lower. You know, I was broke. I'd lost my flat. I'd lost my apartment and I'd lost my job, you know, and I was drinking heavily. And I just didn't need to be in that state because I wasn't that kind of person. I was, that's wrong to say that kind of person. Nobody deserves to be in that state. But I mean, I was really wanted to work hard, but I just wasn't getting it. Nothing was going right for me. And so I felt like the whole thing gave me an opportunity to restart my life and reevaluate it and discover, you know, the true authentic me and be confident to become creative. Yeah.
Yeah. I can keep going with the questions, but I have my colleagues here. I'll pass you on to Steve.
Hey, David, welcome. Thank you for being here. Incredible story. I'm just kind of curious. I have all sorts of ideas about, you know, possibly what the meaning of life is and why we're here. But when you were over there, did you have any sense of a life review or reincarnation or any information like that? I didn't read your book, so I'm just sort of asking you cold.
Sure. I didn't actually have a life review. I know that various people do have life reviews when they have NDEs. I guess, in all fairness, when occasions that I've read about people having life reviews, it tends to be because, you know, they may have gone through life sort of, you know, making other people's lives hard, you know, in terms of war and stuff like that. And they may have killed people or what have you. So they have a life review. Whereas for me, that wasn't the case. I think that my life review was I was the only person. I'm no saint. I'm not trying to say that I was this wonderful person to everybody, but I figured really that the one person that I was being beating up throughout my whole life was myself, because I was. And so the lessons that I learned there were to be loved, and that I am loved, and that was a really powerful lesson. So I kind of figured that's for me. They didn't need to take it any further than that, because I was getting the answers straight away. I suddenly realized, you know, that while I was in that space and in the moment, that I'm okay, I'm all right. You know, I'm not a failure. I'm not a mess. And and in terms of reincarnation, things like that, as I was saying earlier to Carl, you know, I'm continually learning. I feel like I'm still getting information through since I've come back, and that question has been quite big. And I do actually feel that, yes, that we do get reincarnated, because there's no sense, as I said, that for me, that's one thing I learned when I was there, that the soul lives on. So if all our souls live on, if even down to the so that a small fly has a soul, you know, everything. And so there's no space for everything just to suddenly hang out in that realm. So I do feel, yes, that happens, that reincarnation is most certainly the case, and people come back and get reincarnated. Yeah. Oh, sorry, I've lost you.
I was cracking a joke. I said you really went out of your way to get your right brain functioning and, you know, to get to your creative side. But I guess if you put it in terms of religion, or, you know, if for me, I'm not religious, but I always seem to say, would you say there's any truth to the notion that maybe even Jesus was saying, when he was saying, look within or know thyself, it was sort of know that fearless, unjudging self. And in a sense, was part of that message, or is part of the game here, to wake up to that so that we can actually kind of get out of here, that we could, you know, self-actualize and I guess become interstellar or not be in a body anymore. We've learned our lesson. So is maybe part of the message for the average human, is part of the game here to wake up to our true infinite self within, that's within our soul self, that's infinite and eternal. And, you know, to sort of get out of here, in a sense, get out of this matrix.
Oh, well, most certainly. Yeah. I think that, you know, it's you don't have to have a near-death experience or a train accident like mine to get in touch with your inner body. You know, we can all do it. And I think it's something that a great lesson we could all take, because once you start doing it, I mean, I practice it all the time. I go to spiritual healing. I do lots of meditation just to do that, just to keep myself grounded. And I just feel that I'd look around and I just think, I wish more, we could all do that more, you know, because far too many of us are too sort of distracted, you know, where we're too sort of thinking, oh, you know, I've got to get a career. I've got to buy a house. I've got to buy a car, you know, and all these different things that, which are, yeah, they're essential, but people tend to lose the kind of real most important thing is to sort of, it's to be authentic, really, just to be authentic to yourself. And once you find that authenticity, that life can become more simple. It's so many people say, I simply haven't got time. My life's too busy, which is not true at all, because we can find that time. It's just, that's madness. You know, people can find time to sit down and watch their favorite TV program for half an hour or an hour and stuff. So they, you know, so, but not just that, you know, it's just like, if you think about it, a good analogy is like when you're in a car and when you get stopped at the traffic lights, you know, and the light goes to red, there's two ways you could approach it. You could either go, oh man, the light's on red, I'm going to be late for my appointment, you know, or you could turn around and say, okay, the light's on red, I'm just going to stop now and I'm just going to look around and chill and just go with him into my inner body and just relax and just maybe just have a look around and see what's happening in the trees and what's the birds just for that moment in time. Because it's really not going to make that much difference if you're late for a meeting, whether you're going to be held up by 1 minute more, you know. So that's the way I see it, you know.
Yeah. I gotcha. Yeah. I mean, if we could say that everything, you know, love the imperfect, that's sort of what I say, because I'm so busy trying to be perfect that, you know, or get everything right, that being wrong is probably the goal in a sense. Like, you know, get it wrong, you know.
Yeah, let exactly.
It be late. I mean, I guess sort of on the same thing, if at a higher level, there's sort of nothing but love and understanding, and perhaps everything we are concerned with down here fades away, almost probably anything we're physically concerned with, these things are of no consequence on the other side. Like, you didn't screw up. You weren't a failure. You know, there, maybe those things don't even exist in that kind of thinking. But in terms of people suffering here, or let's say some of the subjects we cover are quite dark, and let's just say someone is a child and going through torture, torment, maybe being sex trafficked, did you get any sense that this is a life that's chosen, or did you get any sense that at a higher level, when they pass, there was some sort of contract between their abuser and them, and it's all, everything's in perfect, divine order, or, you can be on the other side and be pissed off. You know, what the hell were you doing to me down there? You know, yeah. I don't like, yeah. I'm sort of trying to see, is everything forgiven? And if so, then you might say, well, then, you know, we could do whatever we want here.
Wow. It's a real tough one, that, because you know, I don't want to turn around and say that everyone should be forgiven for their sins and whatever they do wrong, because that's simply not feasible and it's not doable. But for the people who are like the child that you talked about, who's been sex trafficked and has been tortured and stuff like that, there is a way out. There is a future for them, you know, if they can be given that love, and not only that, if they can be nurtured into finding that self-worth and that self-love. And that's literally what it's all about, you know. It's just because until you've got that, until you've found it, then life is simply hopeless, and then you will remain in that space, if you like, and you will remain in that pain body and in that in the energy field. So, I'm sorry if I'm not really that's answering.
That. Well, we're all, in a sense, we're all co-creating, and we all have probably been darkness, the darkness that we despise. I've probably been many times in other lives. So, I think part of my question is the goal to sort of, you know, have a sense of compassion and love for everyone, even the bad guys? And because we're all just consciousness fractals co-creating and playing roles in a sense.
Well, basically the goal is to have self-love. It's not so much just talking about having love for other people, because that's not really what it's about for me. I think it's all about finding that self-love, and once you can find that self-love in yourself, then you will be able to give love to others, and then you will be able to forgive others, and then you will find that you don't want to sort of destroy other people's lives. You know, that's pretty much what it's all about. You know,
Yeah, that's amazing. So the last question I'll ask in that thread is, so what is did you get a sense of a force that is part of the ego that is always, you know, just sort of on us to maybe make us turn left when we should turn right, or, you know, be hard on us, or, you know, or not be, you know, prevent us from loving ourselves, or, you know, or that whatever that aspect of really being hard on ourselves for no reason, where does that come from? Is that sort of like part of duality? It's necessary to have this physical experience. We need to have the love and the possibility, and we also need to have the, you know, the obstacle and the guy whispering in your ear, you know, you idiot, and, you know, you should have done this, you should have done that.
Well, it starts with conditioning, really, doesn't it? It'll in many aspects, it'll start within the family, you know, like sibling rivalry, and then when you get to the school playground, it'll start with the kids who were bullied by their parents at home, so they started bullying you in the playground, and that's where it all starts. And so we're conditioned to sort of constantly be on guard, and then the ego really starts to kick in there, and then as we become adults, the egos train our minds to say that I'm going to protect you. You need me, which is totally untrue. We don't need the egoistic mind. You know, that is the part of our sort of selves that don't actually belong to us. They are kind of fictional characters that we've started to build for ourselves. You know, we turned ourselves around and said, okay, so I'm a successful guy working, you know, on Wall Street or whatever, and that's because I've done well. I've got a great car. You know, there's nothing wrong with having a great car. There's nothing wrong with working on Wall Street. But what I'm trying to say is that's the egoistic mind saying that's me. That's my identity. Whereas, I'm talking about sort of stripping all that down and letting go of the egoistic mind and just allowing the higher consciousness, the inner body to actually come through, because that is the pureness of us. And once we get in touch with that, that's when our lives start to become balanced and we start to enjoy it. We start to embrace it, you know.
Gotcha. Well, I'm going to pass you to Herman, but what's the quickest way to shut off the fear and get to your inner self, that presence that Eckhart Tolle talks about?
Yeah, he does. Yeah, absolutely. Meditation, I find, is a really great way to do it, because if you can meditate, it's just really brilliant, because it's a great way of just like, you know, he's just shutting out all those different things like, oh, I better do this. Oh, I've got to do this. I've got to phone this guy or that guy. You just, all that goes. And then you just literally find that eventually, the more meditation you do, the more you get in touch with that authentic, real you. That's the core of your soul. So,
wow. Yeah. Fantastic. Awesome. Just really awesome. So maybe I'll get another go, but Hartman.
Thank you. Wow. David. Yeah. I want to come to the higher self and the expression of the higher self. I want to talk about that. I listened to your music, The Divine Light, and what I feel was there's the harmony. Then the mind says, okay, the harmony must go like this, And then there's a break, and there is so many surprises in the music. It's like breaking all the patterns in the mind. It's unbelievable.
Ah, thank you.
Yeah,
that's great.
And, interesting is, for example, also your last painting where the guy walks on the street and see this light. Is it for you like in a radio, for example, where you have a frequency band and you have expand the frequency band so that you can switch in this reality or switch on this frequency whenever you want to?
I find that once I feel an idea will just come to me and I think, right, I've got to develop that. Like that first piece of music that you heard, that came to me. Initially, I thought it was the first piece of music that I wrote for orchestra based on my near-death experience. And I'd never done anything for orchestra before. I'm not trained to work with orchestras. And in fact, I can't read or write music. So that was great in a sense, because I decided I was going to write a song about my near-death experience, because I thought that's all I can do. But that wasn't coming. It wasn't happening. And then suddenly this chord progression, all I got was a little cheap old synthesizer that I bought in Spain. And I was using that and an old cassette recorder. And I just, the opening chords were written like that because I just heard them. And I just started layering, got the sounds via that little synthesizer. And then I thought, this has got to be performed by an orchestra. You know, this is an orchestral piece. And there was a lot of synchronicity tended to happen after my near-death experience. One of them was that I'd met a really good cellist and we became friends and we met for coffee and she said, oh, what are you up to? And I said, look, I'm working on this piece of music. It feels like it should be played by an orchestra. And she laughed and said, maybe we could play it. And I thought, well, that'd be good, you know. So my brother turned around and he helped me because he said, look, I've got this a piece of software that you can attach to once you get your laptop, which I did eventually, you can attach it to that and you can play it on the keyboard, then it will transpose it into musical notation. And then I did that and printed it all off. And then the orchestra agreed to play it and perform it. So even though I'd only written the first movement initially before the actual concert, the other two just followed suit really, really quite simply. But that's great description that you gave before, because I'd never even thought about it, because I didn't intellectualize it, because I'd never done anything like this before. So everything that I was writing, I would say that I was channeling ideas through. So the ideas were coming through from a different frequency, but I didn't ever call upon them. You know, I didn't turn and say, oh, hey, I need your help now. You know, I just found that the help was coming and I knew when it was coming because the ideas were suddenly like, wow, that's beautiful. I can't, but that, and I, that's not me. I did not write those chords. That chord progression came from somewhere else. So, you know, it's an interesting process that I still use. You know, I'm still channeling and tuning into them, and still, it sounds very boastful, but it's not. But I will still sit back sometimes and I go, wow, that's amazing. You know, because I just know that it's not completely me that has just put this together.
Do you have the feeling that after this NDE, you have much more presence in your life?
That you totally, are. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's incredible. So it's to me, I always describe my life now as being more three-dimensional. Before it was two-dimensional. So yeah, I'm much more, you know, other people I've spoken to have had the NDEs will say the same thing. You know, you just become a lot more in touch with nature and the universe itself. Like I'm very much a part of, feel that we are such a part of that universe, because when I was in that other realm, I knew that I was actually eventually that I was in the universe itself. So yeah.
We had, I forgot his name, a wonderful guest a couple of weeks ago here. It was from you, Jane. And he said, concerning the ego, every time you argue to be right in your mind, it is ego talk.
Yeah.
And the problem is many times, for example, I know it by myself, I'm in the ego talk. And then I made, let's say, a system, or I made a sentence so that it can so that I calm down. And then I can see all the colors also better. Yeah. And yeah. for me, I think it's in your case, it's yeah, Franco De Nicola. Yeah, thank you so much.
Brilliant.
Yes.
Brilliant.
And in your case, for example, also in your paintings, when I see it, for example, especially also the man who walks on the street, this touched me very much because it seems the reality, the 3D dimensional reality, and also directly the connection to the higher self.
Yeah.
This yeah, is well, brilliant to see.
Oh, that's great. That's a lovely description. Again, thank you. That's brilliant. Yeah, that I mean, that was I did that because I really wanted like a self portrait of you, if you like. That was me. That was in my previous life, leading up to the accident. As I'm walking through the streets of London, broke down on my luck, and then I wanted to show like the whole world is just suddenly turning around into this turbulence and drawing me into that tunnel of white light, basically. So it's just what was ahead of me. That because I also feel that the whole thing was kind of all premeditated. It was meant to happen to me. It didn't, you know, it was part of the plan, if you like, that was about to happen. So,
it's interesting because as a spectator to the painting,
yeah,
I don't see the past, I see the present.
Yeah, okay,
because
that's great. Yeah.
You go through the long streets of London and have directly access, for example, directly access to this consciousness, to this light, and this yeah. is brilliant to see.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Yeah, great.
And when you're, for example, when you see, you also painted your death experiment, also with this hand, which was completely blood of flesh. It was scary.
That's right.
Yeah, it was a really scary picture. how did you... How did you feel that you were out of the body? Did you have the feeling that you were out of the body, or could you see yourself? Or
yeah, I could see because it was one of the first things I did was to check my wounds because I'd seen how badly messed up it was, and everything was back in place. There wasn't a single scratch or bruise. And I remember thinking, wow, this is my body's back, great, you know. And but it's interesting because it felt like it was me that was there. Going back to what we were talking about before about the egoic mind, it wasn't me with the egoic mind. It was just me with the pure essence of my authentic self that was there, my pure soul. But it was still me. It was still myself, David, and almost talking to myself, going, "Right, okay, well, this is great. You know, my body looks good. I'm happy. I'm, you know." And so I was feeling all the emotions of joy, basically. So I was still feeling emotions. So it was most certainly me, and it was most certainly my body, and it didn't look any different, other than that it was fixed.
Okay. Oh, brilliant! You wrote a book. I must admit, I didn't read the book either. But
that's okay. Yeah.
What is the core of the book? What do you want to tell our audience? What is the core of the book? What's dealing about?
Well, it's basically a journey because it's not just about a near-death experience. It's also about my transformation, basically. The story starts just before the accident, where I'm with my friend Anna, and I'm sort of struggling with the fact that she's a really the first beautiful soul that I've met for a long time, and I was struggling with myself to have a relationship with her because I just felt that I couldn't do it, you know. I wasn't up to it. And I was struggling with that and fighting with that. And so after the actual accident and the NDE itself, myself and Anna became really close, as you would do, because we'd both been through something really intense. So after only knowing each other for 2 weeks, we suddenly became really intense friends. And so it talks not only about our friendship, but it talks about how I evolve as a person and how I, you know, yes, I gained new abilities doing the paintings and then the music, but it just talks about how it's within us all, really, to be able to do that, to be able to find those inner gifts, you know. And that's the message I want to get across. And the way we find that as a starting point is through the self-love. So that's the main core of the book, which is talking about the self-love and me discovering it from being this guy who just thought he was a nothing and a nobody. Yeah.
Do you think, for example, in coach seminars, many people or not many good coaches say that we have to disconnect the outworld from the inworld?
Yeah.
Do you think, as in the same way that, for example, that the inworld, for example, I can have peace in myself, doesn't matter what is outside?
Yeah, totally. That's where it's all at. Just because that's where I was at in the actual, in the other realm. You know, there was peace within myself. Like I say, there was no sense of time. I was no longer. I used to, throughout the whole of my life, I was always concerned with the past and the future. You know, not the present. I was always thinking, oh man, I messed up yesterday. Oh man, I messed up a year ago. I've done so many mistakes in my life, and I carried all that with me like huge bags. And not only that, I was thinking, how am I going to pay the rents? What's going to happen about my future? So I can never stop and really be within the presence and be there with myself. So yeah, I mean, it's most certainly all about sort of just being, you know, within the higher consciousness, you know, within the inner body, you know. Of course, we have, you know, the outside world exists, but once we can go through life and try and feel that essence of our inner authentic selves, it makes life a lot easier. Yeah.
And this is, for example, the summary for my last question is kind of summary. For example, at the moment concerning the lockdown and all that stuff, many people, I think many, many people are in the same situation like you were.
Mm. Yeah.
And let's say it's a hidden poverty. It's not some poverty which you can see real directly, but the poverty is hidden, and they are very frustrating. And for example, in Germany, in Berlin, the suicides have decreased by 300 or 400%. Yeah, I don't know. Wow. 300%. So do you have a message for the people outside who are right now really suffering and thinking, how shall we go on?
Yeah, basically it's to try to stop letting the ego mind put fear into you, because like I was talking about myself, how I was before, and I was worried about, you know, what was going to happen next rather than being in the present. We were given a really good opportunity. I know that it's been a really tough time for us, and it's awful that you just told me those statistics, the suicide rates. But we were actually also initially given a really good opportunity to stop. You know, none of us had to go to work anymore. None of us had to worry about getting up and making money. We were almost forced to stay at home, and people initially were, you know, baking bread and sort of doing art and creating and teaching their kids, and it was wonderful. But then people started getting sort of scared and impatient and saying, we need to get back to normal. We're worried. We you know, and I was thinking, no, don't rush it, because things will find their way, and they really will. So it's just a question of just having trust in that, you know, just try to have a bit of trust in it, because, you know, fear eats the soul, basically. And that's what has happened in a lot of cases, because it's unnecessary fear.
Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you so much, David. I passed
Thank to you. Great. Great questions. Thank you. Thanks. Yeah.
I guess. Thank you. A fantastic conversation. You have an awesome, unbelievable experience, David. And see, I come from the Philippines, and stories like this are common. We can believe that. At the same time, I am also a nurse, so we hear stories similar to yours, except that yours is your post-near-death experience is, it's outstanding transformation of having that skill of fantastic paintings. Now, before I bring my question, Let me just share what the audience said, one of them, okay? He says, hey, David, I have a question. Have you ever read Journey of Souls by Michael Newton? Are you familiar with that? If so, what's your take on it?
No, I've not read that book. I'm actually dyslexic, and so I struggle with reading, so it takes me a while to get through books. But I definitely will check that out. So I'm afraid I can't answer that one. Yeah, with not reading it.
That's still perfect. Perfect.
Yeah, sorry.
So I remember that you mentioned in one of your interviews that you never even know that there are other people who have experienced near death. Is that my correct? When you realize it was a near death.
Yeah, yeah.
There's an organization or there's a group of other people.
Well, what happened was, when it first happened, when I came round, I knew nothing about near-death experiences because, spirituality never came into my mind or into my sphere. And so, I actually thought I was the only person this had happened to. And that's why I started painting, because I thought, I've got to tell the world about this. I'm going to do a huge painting. And that's where it all started from that point. Then, of course, when I came out of hospital, I started going online and trying to find research and finding some answers, well, some affirmation, really. And then that's where I read about Dr. Raymond Moody. And once I started doing my first painting, I then came across a spiritualist church in the small town where I was recovering. And I went there and I just walked through their door one summer's day and sat through one of their services, which was really beautiful. And then at the end, I just got chatting with them and told them what had happened. And they got it straight away. They were saying, oh, yeah, you had a near-death experience, they were saying, that's amazing. You were very lucky. You were very gifted to have been through all that, and they explained it all to me. So I learned an awful lot through them,
So among the people you have talked with, what other commonalities do you all have other than what I already heard about when you said about not having that self-love or feeling like you're almost down the rabbit hole? It seems like after that, there's always like a transformation. Are there any more other things that were common before and then after? Now, after, maybe not everyone painted because you're the only exceptional one who...
Yeah, but I'm also keen to stress that it's not all about, everybody comes back with the same thing, and that is getting in touch with their higher consciousness, and they all get in touch with their inner bodies, as I called it earlier. And so that everyone does that. So they find their calling afterwards. They'll become teachers. Many of them do become teachers, and a lot of them become speakers, which they would never have done before. And so, it was just in my case, I just think that was my... that was my calling for me to come back creatively. I think the other thing that I have, the people that I have come across that I've spoken to have got very similar stories to mine as well, because, their lives before were complete contrast. They were living life in the fast lane. They were just kind of really going for it. And it's almost like they were heading for disaster as well. And so... So there's very much of a common ground with that, where they come from that. But the main thing is that it stays with everybody. It becomes, you can't shake it off. It stays very much a part of their lives. And it becomes, everybody comes back and says, what is my purpose? What am I going to do now? What comes next?
One of my energy teachers used to say, once you feel the energy, you can never turn back. You will always feel that. So, there's this response from Peter who asked that question about the book. He said, oh, okay, I understand. Thank you. I'd be interested to hear your take when you do get around to it. Anyway, really enjoying this talk. So he appreciates it.
Thank you for that, please. That's really kind of you to get back with a response. That's great.
Yeah,
I will look into it. I promise you. Yeah, definitely.
And then, although it was fascinating to hear, you also said that I assume you never did meditation before. So, you know, okay. And yet at that moment, you were present because you remembered what would James Bond do?
Yes.
So I guess it's nice to hear that, so that for the listeners and the viewers, it just takes a second to be in the moment. And we don't need to have that fancy training and, you know, so not to be disappointed that, because some people cannot handle meditation, or they it is a challenge for them to have that meditation.
Yeah, especially. I know. Yeah. It's true. Yeah.
And also, I know that we talk about the ego, and just like I don't want to demonize ego a lot, because in that moment also, when you think about yourself, that is also what they're thinking about, is leading us with our ego, because that's even, and then at that moment when you also said that, I'm going to share this. So the moment we did even use the I, that's already part of that. So ego, for me, plays a good role at certain point.
Yeah.
Just being attached to something. Now, with your painting, you mentioned that there's a white light, and your paintings are beautiful, vibrant colors. When you have that near-death experience, did you see other colors than white?
Oh, yes, that was it. That's why they're all in there, all those colors. All those colors were everything that I saw, and that's what I was really keen to get across. You know, there was one point of the experience that was really beautiful that I was worried about my family, because I thought they had all been distressed in the hospital. I thought, well, I'm clearly dead now. They're going to be very upset. So I tried to look over the edge of this huge rock that I was laying on, and I thought I'd see them in the hospital, but I didn't actually see them at all. But what I did see was this incredible waterfall of stars. It was like a beautiful sort of large arc. It was almost like of stars, like the size of Niagara, but it was like millions of stars cascading over the edge. And I thought, wow. And it was just awesome. And I looked down and all I could see was one galaxy going into another. And then that's when I saw the colors, the nebulas and everything within that galaxy, sort of field was just like, they were just spectacular and really beautiful. So I really wanted to incorporate all the colors that I saw, and all those powerful flames as well. They were full of rich colors.
Yeah. I think those are primary colors as well. You know, because when we do energy testing, and it seems like all the primary colors just really test, the energy tests really good, like it protects our biofield when all those primary colors. That's why behind me is a bright purple color.
Brilliant, yeah.
And also, my question also, from among the group, again, of your conversations with them, is there anyone of you know who had a near-death experience outside the hospital, outside any type of influence of a surgery, outside any type of medication?
Not personally that I've met. No, yeah, I'm afraid not, yeah.
Yeah, so, and it's not, I'm not being skeptical in terms of your experience, because I believe your experience. It just seems like a lot of the stories I hear is when they are going through that influence of being on the table or having that whatever in the hands of the, you know, and see it. And it's not bad, as I said, not bad. Sometimes that's just, as you mentioned, it was like our And I will agree with Steve and Hartmut when you said, like, as if we made a contract somewhere before we came to Earth. Okay, let me go through this. And then,
sure.
There is one of whom I know, and if I heard him right, he passed away already, Dr. David Hawkins. When it happened to him, he was a young boy distributing newspaper in, I forgot what state, but it was so cold, it was snowstorm, really bad. So he was riding his bike, he had to find a shelter. So he made, he dug a hole in that pile of snow so he can be there. And that's when, and just like you said, David, that you said you were thinking of your mother, or you think of your family, right?
Yeah.
She was also thinking, and he said he decided to come back, not out of guilt, but he just couldn't afford that his father will be so sad, you know. So he said, so, but that it happened, he's the only one for now, and that he was the one after that who really made that
transformation
of the map of consciousness.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting actually, because when you talked about that that feeling about, you know, worrying about his family and stuff like that, the feeling I had about worry was totally different than, it wasn't a feeling of guilt at all. Because interestingly enough, just before the NDE itself, when my family came in to see me, I remember my mother coming over to me and she was like, with tears in her eyes. And I was saying to her, I was saying, "Mom, I'm so sorry. It's always me bringing the dramas to this family." So I was apologizing for myself then. You know, she was going, "It's not your fault. Stop it." You know, so that's the kind of person I was. But in the NDE itself, when I started thinking about my family, I didn't have that same feeling of, "Oh my goodness, my family, they're going to be so upset now." There was, when I didn't see them, I remember thinking, "Okay, well, I can't see them now, but you know, they'll be fine. They're going to be coming up here soon. They're going to be experiencing all the joys here. So they'll be okay." You know, so it's interesting how that changes. But also, you know, it's all NDEs happen when some people are in the hospital and they clinically die, but not all people do. You're at a stage where you're on the cusp of almost dying as well. You know, you are near death basically. So I guess that's why so many people are in hospitals. And obviously I've had questions put to me by, when I've done interviews, where people turn around and say, "Well, what about the question that it could be the medication may have induced this or made or brought this on?" And so when I wrote the book, I decided to get, I contacted my hospital and I wrote to the hospital and I paid to have all the medical records sent through, because a friend of mine, she lectures in nursing. So I asked her to look through the medications that I would have been on to see if they were hallucinogenic or they would have been in any sense brought this on. And there weren't any drugs at all that were in my system at that point of the actual NDE that would have made that happen. So that was great. I mean, it's not a needed confirmation, but I needed that just to sort of help me to explain, you know, my journey and my situation, really. Yeah.
And this one is for you to maybe search or connect with him. I know of Dr. Jerry Duhenio, and he had that near-death experience. And same, again, you know, being above and you're seeing your body right in the hospital. And he had a super overdose of all different cocktails of drugs, okay? Yeah, but one significant thing that he found out is that during the test, they never found any trace of drugs that he took.
Oh, wow. That's
but he amazing. Knew he did it. He knew he did it.
That's
he
remarkable. Was afraid.
He, you know, because all his life, that's what he did, you know, women party. And you know. So right now, it took him a while. As you said, it took you, 6 months and a few months, and then you're painting. So this one, he now has been downloading codes for infinite consciousness, for morphogenetic you know, bioresonance, and he now created a technology. So he just created Bioregenesis University, and because he has downloaded, he went into a realm really and been slowly given that all yeah. that encoding. So
fantastic.
So I appreciate all your experience and those people, because it seems like you're giving us more messages of what we can do here on earth as it is in heaven. Now, if a child comes to you and asks you, what is death, David? What would you say?
Well, that actually happened. I was doing an interview, and a young child, the guy who was interviewing me, he was in Australia, and his daughter walked in. At the point when I was telling my near-death experience, and so it was really lovely because I suddenly found myself, you know, talking as if I was talking to a child and stuff. So, but I hardly changed anything. I suddenly thought I don't need to. I didn't have to alter it because there was a young 5-year-old child there. I thought everything that I said just fitted fine to tell a child. And not only that, I also believe that we don't give children enough credit. We think they're mm-hmm. children, and so we're always telling them don't do this or do that, for their own goods, you know, because we feel that. But you know, they're actually great little people. I mean, one thing I've never forgotten, when I was throughout my time recovering in hospital, when they used to pick me up in a wheelchair and take me down to the physiotherapy room, to you know, which is at the basement of the hospital, and we used to have to pass through the children's cancer ward every time we went through, and I used to see these young poor little kids, you know, who were having chemotherapy. And it was like the roles had reversed, because they were sat in their wheelchairs with their parents, and the parents looked obviously completely drained, which they would do. But the children, I thought they had this kind of light coming out of them, and they looked really kind of at peace, you know, very peaceful. And they were like holding their parents' hands, almost like giving them love. And it was just so that stayed with me. And I always feel it. So with children, I always give them a lot more sort of time than I would have done before. So I would hardly change it. I'd hardly change the story, because it's all real and it's authentic, you know. There's nothing to change.
Thank you so much. I'll pass it on to Jane.
Great. Thank you.
David, after this happened, you had an incredible experience too, where you met these healers, and there must have been a lot of pain in your body at the time because you still needed to heal. But I remember you saying that you actually levitated off the table.
That's right, yeah.
So do you think that was because you had like an upshift in vibration, where you were of a higher vibration, so that happened easier? And then did that slowly wear off, or like just describe that?
Yeah, I was... when I first started going for those healing sessions, yeah, I felt like I'd still got a very strong connection to this other realm. I felt like I've got an umbilical cord attached to it, and the energy was still flowing through me for quite some time. So when I was in those healing sessions, the healers used to turn around afterwards and they say, "Oh, we're really enjoying healing you, because you're like an open vessel. You're just absorbing all this energy. It's coming straight through." And so, it was only afterwards that they told me that I was levitating off the table. I thought I was, but I thought, I'm not going to say that I was, because no one said anything. But it was only months later they told me that. They said, "Do you realize that you used to levitate off the table?" I said, "Yeah, I remember." So I guess I must have been still very highly tuned to that higher vibration. And I guess that, you know, I needed an awful lot of healing at that point. Because I was totally amazing my consultants. You know, I was going back in and out of hospital like 3 times a week to start off with. And they would turn around saying, "David, you're healing remarkably quick. We can't get over it. You know, whatever you're doing, keep doing it." And then I started to tell them that I was having spiritual healing. And they kind of like, it was almost like the wires were starting to fuse in their head. They were going, "Oh, no, okay, we don't need to know about that."
That can't be possible.
Yeah.
What was it like to have that umbilical cord, that feeling of being connected?
It felt amazing. It just felt great. And because it was just, I was just waking every day, just couldn't wait for every day. Every day was just fantastic, you know. And I looked around the world like it was like, I was going, this is heaven on earth. This is beautiful. This is, earth is such a beautiful place, you know, and I couldn't stop appreciating all of nature's beauty. And I was totally fixated with watching documentaries on astronauts going into space, because I felt, well, they've been out into the universe, and I felt I'd been out into the universe. I wanted to see what their take was on it. And that was great, because I mean, these are the scientists of all scientists who get this job to sit in a rocket and fly to the moon, as these guys were. And many of them were turning around and coming out with some really spiritual stuff. What they felt when they're on the moon, stood looking back at the Earth and looking out at the universe itself. And so I felt there was an awful lot in common with that. But many of them would also say that the same thing, that when they came back through the Earth's atmosphere and back into Earth, they said for the first few weeks or months, you just have that same sensation as myself, that the Earth is heavenly and beautiful and colorful, which it is.
Right. And when you connect to that energy of love, you actually see the beauty in it. When you're not connected, you see everything as all the turmoil and the pain. But there's moments like where I felt that absolute connection, and you can just see the beauty in every creation.
Yeah, that's lovely, isn't it? Beautiful.
do you have any of your paintings there that you could show the audience? I know last time you had one really close.
I'll see if I can find one. I'll be back.
Okay. And do any of you guys have any final questions while David's hunting for that or looking for moving his painting?
I want to ask him whether this consciousness, what the consciousness of the expanding of the consciousness, what the result is in his environment. Because, for example, we all, without death experiment, we have expanding consciousness. And let's say we are the black sheep. So the situation is,
can you see that?
There it is.
So beautiful. So that's you on the slab, and then the people that, well, they're the spirits, really, isn't it, that were around you, healing you. And there's the tunnel as well.
Wow. He can't hear you because he had put up his ears.
We'll get him to describe it. So, David, describe that painting. Oh, his ear. Here's your phone. Sorry.
Sorry, Jen. I couldn't hear a single word of that.
No, I really, Hartmut knew.
Well, so, I thought I'd hold it up for a while so you could see it. So, yeah.
So beautiful. What were you saying? So just describe that painting and what was in it.
Yeah, sure. That was showing myself laid out on the big huge rock that I talked about, the slate rock, and covered in the blue blanket, and then looking up and seeing the androgynous being who was greeting me with the black t-shirt, and then beyond that is the tunnel of white light itself with all the dramatic flames that were slowly circulating around. But there's a lovely story actually that I just wanted to tell you. Actually, just talking about that, it just came to me that when I first came out of the hospital, I started looking into NDEs online. One thing I did find, I'd found this image that a child had done, a very young child, an infant who'd had an NDE, and it was amazing because it was just like, it was like a very basic stick drawing, you know, sort of a child laid out on a table with stick people, two women either side with their hands, stick hands going out over her body. And then right ahead of her was another being just stood there that was the being of light, almost like I saw. And then behind that was like what looked like a sort of a Cornetto ice cream cone sort of like flying through the sky. And that was obviously the tunnel of white light. And I remember I was recovering at my sister's at the time. I just gave her a call and said, Janet, come and look at this. And she started crying. She said, my goodness, that's everything you've described. It's everything that you're painting in your first painting. And we just said, that's remarkable, isn't it? And that was the first moment of lovely, beautiful affirmation, you know, because, you know, the honesty of the child's drawing was just so pure.
Yeah, just simpler.
Yeah, well, as Picasso said, you know, he spent his whole life trying to create like a child, you know.
Right. I'm just going to open it up to any last questions. And then, David, for sure, just explain how people can find your website and see your drawings and hear your music.
Sure.
I think Hartmut has a question.
Yes, I have a final question. Because of the expanding of your consciousness, how has changed your environment? Did you only make good experience about that, or did you also make bad experience about this, for example, with the death experience? Because if you have an expanded mind, and that means that you have, let's say, you have overcome borders of fear where other people have a lot of fear. You understand what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. I would like to know, how did your environment react to your being right now? Because you have overcome a border of fear, yeah. and they normally the people are limited to this, and they can't handle the situation what you have experienced.
Yeah,
they can feel this.
It's absolutely true, because like I said to you, for the first 6 months I was just feeling absolutely blissful and wonderful and happy about every single day. And then once I came out of hospital and I was well enough, the rail police wanted to do a legal inquiry. And so there was a court case, you know, lawyers involved. And so the harsh reality of that system, which is very, very severe, I wasn't used to it. So I was being dissected and pulled apart, and I just couldn't handle it because it was worlds apart from where I'd just been, and I wasn't equipped to deal with that. So my environment at that point was in danger, if you like. I was in danger of being sucked back into feeling negative about myself and life. But once the actual thing was all over and it was all settled, it was amazing how my life just suddenly just kind of got back onto the highway, you know. And I was just like, I found this apartment that I'm living in now, which was like, it was almost like it was meant for me, because it's like beautiful sunlight coming through every day. It's an old converted mill. The energy is beautiful. It means I can create here. I can paint, I can write, and I'm inspired as well at the same time. So it's like, it was like I was attracting it, you know. I was suddenly attracting that energy for positivity to come back in my life again, I guess, if that answers what you were asking me.
Yes. Brilliant. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you so much.
No worries. Thanks.
So, Carl, Steve, any questions?
I was going to say, in terms of the universe having your back, I mean, do you live with a sense of faith? Do you live with a sense of, are you always in the present moment? You know, do you have a sense of synchronicity that things are going to work out? Or, you know, do you have that, you know, is that something that kind of comes with, you know, discovering your presence and your inner self, where you become less fearful and you just sort of trust. And I guess everything that you thought was important maybe isn't, but there's a sense if you allow the universe, it will have your back and support you.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've been faced with, I mean, for example, only 2 years ago, I had quite a big health scare. It was post the accident. I got internal bleeding, and it caused like this sort of like an internal rupture. But when they looked at it on the X-ray, they said this could be cancer, and if it is, it's quite big. So I was faced with that thing, you know, that this could be cancer. That's quite a big test for me, and I found it really, really, really helpful to know that I could deal with it and I could go within myself. I noticed that everybody around me was more frightened. You know, my loved ones and my friends were just terrified. They were petrified because just the thought of cancer is very scary to us all. But I was able to deal with it and process it and go through with it quite well, I would say, you know, all considering. And so a lot of it is to do with, because it's not just to do with having self-love and from having the ND, it's because I've learned to sort of, you know, teach myself to sort of try and get grounded and teach myself to meditate and to go within and not to allow sort of stop be worrying about creating images of what might happen, you know, what could happen. Oh my goodness, am I going to have chemotherapy? I didn't think about all those things. I didn't allow it to enter into my thoughts. I just allowed myself to be in the moment and think, well, this has happened, but I'm okay. I'm sat on my sofa now. I'm not in any pain. I'm okay. I'm still enjoying my life. I'm still able to write music. In fact, I started writing lots of music at that point, and that really helped me as well. And so that something great came out of that. So it's quite interesting.
That's great. Okay, I'm done. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that. Great question, Esther. Cheers.
I suppose I have a question in the back of my mind, David. Is I'd asked you, excuse me, if this was a gift, and obviously it is. And then I started to think, is this divine intervention? And then I started to think, were there signs before this horrendous event in physical terms? Would there have been, if it was a sort of divine intervention, would there have been warning signs, let's say things that may happen to you that were less intense or dramatic? And then I was sort of thinking, but then it wouldn't have been the experience that it was, which seems to be perfect in itself. So maybe you could just comment on that.
It's funny. There were a couple of little signs that were pointing me to the fact that this was about to happen. An odd experience happened. This is only a couple of months prior. I'd been going to visit my sister up in the town where they lived, and I was on the train and I bumped into an elderly couple, and they were started chatting to me. They wanted to know where the next station was and stuff, you know. And this lady said, oh, we're going to see a medium tonight. She's great. You should come along. And I was going, yeah, thanks. I, to be honest with you, I wasn't interested in, you know, sometimes you don't want to engage in a conversation when you're on a train. And I was like that. But she was quite insistent and said, here, take this flyer. And I said, thanks very much. And I arrived at my sister's, and there was so much chaos going on there with her kids at the time that I said, look, I'm just going to go and have a drink. And I went out for a drink, and I pulled this flyer out, and I thought, I'm going to go. So I went to this mediumship, even though it was nothing at all that had appealed to me. And when I went, it was great because she was brilliant, this medium. She was going through everybody, you know, picking out and coming out with some great messages. Everyone was looking for a, you know, connection with their loved ones. So I wasn't looking for any connection whatsoever. So I sat there viewing all this. And then she suddenly turned around to me and she said, gentleman in the blue sweater over there, she said, your life's about to change. I was going, oh, right. You know, so all I could think was great, the lottery, you know, or the girl I was after, all those different things, you know. And I said, how's it going to change? And she stopped and she was like talking to them. She was communicating. She was going, yeah, okay, you know. And then she turned around to me. She said, they're not telling me, but they're just saying, be ready for it. It's going to be big and just be ready for it. So that was like, that's what drew me to go back to that spiritualist church. I thought, I've got to track this woman down because that was amazing. And so there were funny little signs like that. But actually on the day, just as I was leaving the house to go, I felt the atmosphere. I've never forgotten the sensation that there was something different about that day. And I couldn't put my finger on it. You know, I didn't know what was going on. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I was expecting you to say something more subtle. You know, subtle signs, but that seems to be rather in your face. in a way, I didn't mean it.
No, that's good.
I know what they're telling me.
It's more interesting, isn't it?
but it was, you know, yeah, that's quite a story. Yeah, thanks. I have to think about that a bit. Thanks very much.
That's in the book. That's in the beginning of the book because she's got to be in there. Yeah, the medium. That's fantastic, you know.
Fantastic. Thanks very much. Great story.
Thanks.
So, David, thank you so much. And thank you, everyone, for your amazing questions that made this conversation over the top beautiful. And to our viewers, thank you for listening to this incredible story. David, how do people find you?
Yeah, well, I guess the best places to start is with my website, which is shineonthestory.com. So if you go there, you can find that. And if you want to follow me on social media, you'll find the links to there, like Instagram and my YouTube channel as well. So please do come and have a look. And if you want to contact me, you can, you know, get in touch through those various platforms, I'm sure, yeah, if you'd like to. But thank you for listening, anyone, for everyone who came along. I really appreciate it.
And the book is on your website?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The book is, yeah, well, the book is, but it's available through Amazon. You'll be able to get it. You know, it's selling, it's doing really well and throughout the world. And in fact, Singapore is, we're getting lots of nice 5-star reviews there. So thank you, Singapore. That's really, it's a lovely really surprise. Yeah. Really and go. So, yeah, so it's doing well. USA, Canada, Australia. And so, and it's coming out in French as well. So we just, Hachette, who are like a big publisher in France, have just signed up the rights to it. So that's going to be the next part of the story. So that should be really interesting. Yeah.
Perfect. Well, I feel that your story is just so perfect for this time and that we all need to go with it inside and do exactly what you're saying. And it's just so inspirational to all of us. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks,
everyone.
Thanks,
David. Real pleasure. Thank you.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, good David. To meet you all. Bye-bye. Take care. Bye-bye.
Cheers.